Elvis Presley's first words were, "I hope you have not been bored." Well, that's if you take Paul Muldoon and his poem Famous First Words literally. But let us echo that sentiment as we begin this series. We hope you will not be bored. Each episode over the course of this series, we're going to be spending 30 minutes or so talking about culture, books, music, theatre, films and other weird things that happen. As you might do when you're having a beer with your mates after going to see something or when you've just finished a book. We're not a review show though, and there's no one telling us to stay on topic. People make art to express their ideas and provoke thought and conversation, which is what this show is all about. My name is Dylan Haskins, and at risk of sounding like my internet dating profile, I'm a Dublin lad living in East London, been involved in some music things, some arts things, and even a bit of politics. But I'm nowhere near as accomplished as the woman sitting across from me, Lisa Hannigan.
Wow, thank you for that. Very.
It's over to you now. Now you've got to try and be modest.
Well, I am a nearly Dublin lady, also staying in East London at the moment. I'm a singer songwriter, and I'm working on my third record, among other things. And so, yeah, it's great to be in London with all of these things to go and see and watch and do with my friend Dylan.
Nice sycophantic intro there from both of us.
Yeah.
Well, I began by quoting the Pulitzer Prize winning Irish poet Paul Muldoon, and later on we'll be talking about his book of rock lyrics, The Word on the Street. The street, or more precisely street culture, is something that we'll be discussing having visited the ICA off-site exhibition A Journey Through London Subculture, 1980s to now, which is happening in a stripped bare former hotel building in London. And then for something completely different, we went to see this year's winner of the Palme d'Or at Cannes in May, Abdelatif Kechiche's Blue is the Warmest Colour, a coming-of-age love story that's led to a figurative washing of dirty laundry in the press between the two lead actors and the director. This is Soundings.
Ding, ding, ding. Soundings. Sorry, we don't have a jingle yet.
Yeah, we'll work on that one. Occasionally, naming something is easy. You just know it was always meant to be called that. Your first child, or your bike, or your car, or your house. More often than not, though, it's a trying process consisting mainly of bad puns.
A lot of bad puns.
And people usually get there in the end, or at least lose patience and pick the least bad option. My first band was called Disco Traitor. with exclamation marks instead of eyes.
Because that is incredible.
We were cool, and we were folk punk.
I can tell from your amazing name. I have a friend whose college band, it was a reggae band, and their name was Heavy Flow.
Wow.
Which is quite disturbing.
I mean, it's fine when it's something like a band, because usually they break up eventually, but...
Well, yeah. Well, think of all those poor people with Heavy Flow tattoos, though. You know?
I mean, there are some. Yeah, there was a punk band once which I have a couple of 7 inches by with questionable lyrics, but the band were called Dog Shit Sandwich, which is pretty much the most woeful thing to have in your record collection. And they had the 7 inch entitled was called Gary Glitter is a Filthy, etc. And that was the song. It was like Gary Glitter, you, etc.
Okay.
There are some very famous bands with terrible names
terrible
as well, though.
Terrible names. I think my least favourite band name of all, that every time I hear it just makes me want to reach through the radio and punch them, is Limp Bizkit.
With a Z.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's the bad spelling that really gets to me. I feel like replacing a Z with an S is like, it's the worst sort of lingual bastardization that you can do. It's like putting a pair of sunglasses on a picture of the sun.
And I mean, the Americans do it all of the time. So you're just having a little swipe there.
And obviously, well, the music's horrible as well.
We'll pass that on to Fred Durst.
If you could just let him know, that would be great. Thank you.
Well, some of the suggested names we had for this series were, and I'm going to say this was your one, Me Arts.
Was two Irish people talking about arts. I thought it was perfect.
Arts and Minds, and in homage to Morrissey, Irish Blood, English Arts.
I did quite like that. It didn't really make sense, but I did think it was good.
If we were only talking about the English arts,
indeed,
might have worked. But
indeed. I also thought Arts Blanche afterwards, but then it's too late. Now we're stuck with Soundings, which
stuck
I do quite like. The Soundings is the name of our, any Irish person will know, it's the Leaving Cert poetry book, much beloved. So,
I mean, before my time, but we'll take your word for it.
Well, there's not much that isn't before your time, in fairness. I am your haggard older sister. That's going to be the vibe.
Well, the word on the street is the quite fitting name, I will say. We'll give him maybe an 8 out of 10 for that, of Paul Muldoon's book of rock lyrics, which came out earlier this year. Muldoon has no shortage of accolades, having written over 30 collections of poetry, being professor of poetry at Oxford and now Princeton, and winning the Pulitzer Prize. But this is something a bit different.
When you picked this book up, what were you expecting for starters from the cover alone, which is nothing short of attention?
Well, I was surprised. I was excited about this, the weird idea of it, although a little trepidatious, just because the whole idea of reading lyrics is a tricky one. You know, they're not really meant to be read like that. And even those people that we say are incredible lyricists, like Leonard Cohen, who obviously started out as a poet, but Leonard Cohen or Joni Mitchell or Bob Dylan, you know, you still have the underpinning melody in your head as you're reading them. And I think as I started this book, with all due respect to Paul Muldoon, and he is due obviously an incredible amount of respect, I found it a bit tricky actually to get into. The poems, the lyrics are really charming and funny and clever, but it's when you untether lyrics from a melody, it's really hard to grab a hold of them, I found. I don't know, as I was reading it, I was finding it sort of difficult to kind of to get a grasp on them a little bit, because obviously poetry is written to meter, which you can sort of see on the page as you're reading it with your eyes. But then music is written, or lyrics are written to melody, which you hear with your ears. And it's that sort of disconnect. It was kind of difficult. I found that I, without really thinking about it, had attached some kind of melodic rhythm to it, and then you get to another line. I did the exact same thing.
You're reading and you're like, you're trying to think, what might this sound like? And you're inventing a melody almost in your head, but it's never quite working. It's like a generic song melody.
Yes,
like,
exactly. And then you get to the next line and it doesn't fit, and then you sort of have to start again. And I found it a little more difficult than I thought. Well, I did think that there was so many wonderful bits in it. Although, I must say, I went into a big bookshop and looking for this book, and they said, oh yeah, it should be there. And they went and all of the Paul Muldoon books had been stolen. And she said, oh, they should be there and they must have been stolen. And I said, wow, that's pretty, there's something kind of heartening about people stealing poetry
books. Kind of cool.
Yeah, and she said that the most pilfered sections in bookshops are poetry and philosophy. There was some sort of romantic Lab OM notion about the whole thing. But it was sort of interesting. So I had to get my book through other means. But I think I would, you know, rather read Moy Sand and Gravel or, you know, some
one of his
pure poetry books. But I think this was really good fun.
He's not precious with high culture and low culture. There is no definition mix, but like there's no line separating. These are, you know, I am a poet and these are the high culture things that I will reference to show how
absolutely
intelligent I am. And, you know, lest God forbid that I would ever mention things like
cellulite
or like Hollywood films I've seen or like taking magic mushrooms, all of these types of things, all of which he does mention in this. And in the same, there's a great one. One of the ones I loved was Julius Caesar was a people person. And he talks about Julius Caesar, Machiavelli, Hitler, Stalin. It's like Joseph Stalin was a people person. He liked to put his stamp on people he sent for an excursion to some far flung labour camp, though he wondered why collectives wouldn't fly. He had no truck with self-doubt. 5 years can go by in the blink of an eye when there's no time to laze about. That's why he favoured physical exertion for the social parasite and Jew. Joseph Stalin was a people person like you. Which is, I mean, in this little song or these lyrics, you kind of have a history lesson going, spanning ancient Rome through to Machiavelli to contemporary stuff, and then back to Stalin and his collectivization policy.
I tell you, I actually read it with my Google open and was like looking up loads of. No, and it was fascinating. You know, that's the weird thing I have with this book. I think it was really interesting, and it was really clever and funny and charming. But also the whole idea of reading lyrics, I just find quite difficult. I don't think I would necessarily read Leonard Cohen lyrics or Joni Mitchell lyrics. I think they're just better delivered attached to the melody that they were written against. So I was trying to think about this morning. Some of these like incredible songs have really kind of bad lyrics sometimes, you know, but you can kind of get away with it. I was thinking of great pop song from the last many, many years. Kylie's I Can't Get You Out of My Head, Boy, Your Love Is All I Think About, which written down is pretty throwaway. But then when you attach it to that earworm of a melody, you know, it transfers so much more, you know. And I know it's a simple pop song, but you've got that, a melody can take words to a different place. You can have simple words that, combined with the right melody, mean everything.
Well, there you have it, from Paul Muldoon to Kylie Minogue. But from poetry to film, Blue is the Warmest Colour is a new feature film by French director Abdellatif Kechiche. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in May for both the director and the two lead actors. It tells the intimate coming-of-age story of Adèle, a 17-year-old at high school in Lille, and her realising that she's gay and the forming of her first relationship, becoming a teacher. And that's basically it, but it is a three-hour film.
Yeah, that's what's extraordinary about the film. There really isn't that much plot to it at all. And it's 3 hours long, but I mean, I for one didn't feel it at all. I thought, even though I was kind of hungry, it just flew by. I thought it was the most extraordinary film. I loved it. I just thought it was such a beautiful meditation on like the dynamics of a romantic relationship, a romantic story, and all the heartbreak and passion and desperation that goes along with it. I thought it was absolutely brilliant.
Do you think there was something of the first love about it as well? There was the kind of this is it, and not knowing that stuff comes after that, that life goes on after a relationship, you know, will inevitably breaks up. Your first relationship usually does. It was very much this one girl's maturing and her coming to realisation with herself, and to kind of, you can see her maturity on camera, which might be something to do with the fact that they shot it all chronologically. So the actress, who's also called Adèle, literally does kind of grow with her character through the filming.
Yeah, she starts, I think she's 15 or 16, and she does a great job at that. You know, there's an awful lot of like... she's generally quite sort of sloppy in the way she carries herself, and then as the film goes on, you can really feel her growing into herself and maturing. And it's just a stunning performance from that actress,
who was only 18 at the time of filming,
and which is crazy. I mean, I can't believe she was only. I mean. Wow.
It's hugely naturalistic, isn't it? The acting style in it. I mean, you have at one point where she's quite upset at a point in the film. She has the tears rolling down her cheek and snot hanging out of her nose.
Yeah.
And it's there is no glamorous aspect to that aspect.
That's what's so wonderful about it. It rings so true emotionally and psychologically, I think, you know, in that there's no pretty crying the way just what you normally get in films about, you know, when women cry, they do so in, you know, beautifully lit and looking gorgeous, and it's so ridiculous and unreal. And that's what I loved so much about the movie, is that it felt so true to life, and also that dynamic of the first love with a younger person and a slightly older, more suave, more confident person, and, you know, them sort of showing you the ropes of life. It felt so real to me, more than any other film I think I've seen on the subject. I really felt like it came across as being very real and brutal and beautiful as well.
It was very French as well. There was a lot of you mentioned we were both quite hungry when we were in the screening, trying to discreetly rustling our bags of crisps and getting filthy looks from people at the back.
You bought the loudest crisps that I've ever...
They were all they had around it, but
it was the most French film ever made. When they weren't sort of kissing each other, they were talking about philosophy or poetry,
literally
or
talking,
painting,
name checking Sartre, talking about
having sex or eating oysters. It was
always
incredible.
always eating, always drinking wine. I mean, it was the Frenchest of films.
It was incredible.
And there was time given to things. I think, you know, there were many shots of the wind blowing, basically.
Shots of the wind. It's the most French thing of all. But yeah, the style of filmmaking was beautifully French, in that, you know, there's this great shot of her in the sea, Adèle in the sea, and it's just funny how your brain automatically goes to, when you're watching a film, you know, suddenly they're at the seaside, you think, oh God, somebody's going to drown.
Totally, yeah.
And then in this film with very little plot, you realise, no, it's just
she's just having a swim, that's it.
And but you get so much from the scene still, but, you know, obviously not so much on paper, but that's what I loved about it. I thought it was so brave and so compelling.
It was supposedly the filming process of this was supposed to take about 2 months, but ended up taking 5.5 months, which you can imagine in any project, you know, when it's pushed out further and further. Yeah. It's fine if you're approaching something knowing it's that long, but when it's constantly extended. But there was one particular moment which a lot of people have been talking about after the film, and it would be you can't not talk about it, is the prolonged sex scene, which is about 10 minutes long. I mean, there's a lot of sex scenes, but there's one which is, it's between the two lovers in the film, Adele and Emma. And it's got people talking for a lot of reasons. There was different reactions I noticed in the theatre last night. It was at a point where people were like, is this still happening? Kind of starting to jostle into their seats or stuff.
For me, I thought it was really beautiful, and I didn't feel smutty, didn't feel, you know, gratuitous. It did go on a bit. That was all I thought. I felt like it went on a bit, and it sort of became a tiny bit mechanical. Mm. But it certainly didn't seem pornographic to me. But I felt like it would become the thing that people talk about when they talk about the film, and I think it does the film an injustice for it to overtake.
But it didn't. I did like seeing a sex scene like that on screen, in that it's not about, it was very sexy, but it was, you know, in porn, for instance, the positions that people take up in sex is to suit the camera angle. That wasn't really there in this. It was more the kind of grasping of two bodies close together, yeah, interlocked, trying everything. There was an awkwardness. There was the constant, yeah, sound, which of like the kind of... Which
please don't make the sound. Please.
The sound of people's mouths and kissing and all of that stuff, which is the kind of unsexy but realistic soundtrack to what sex can, yeah, sound like. And I felt like there's the only other sex scene that I can think of that had that kind of naturalistic awkwardness to it was the Dreamers by Bertolucci, where there's like Ava Green and Michael Pitt, and it's their first time for both of them, and you know, he's wearing socks and her leg is quivering, and it has that awkwardness as, okay, well. And I feel I think it's good when that's reflected on screen, because so much of what's reflected about sex on screen and online is not reflective of reality.
Yeah, and actually, you know, what was sort of refreshing about the film as well is that the depiction of feminine sexuality was so powerful and so strong. And so, you know, so often the dynamic of female sexuality is sort of depicted as quite passive, you know, and it was really, I thought it was really moving to see a much more powerful and sort of active sense of passion. And one of the interesting bits about the movie is that the young character, Adele, who's much younger than Emma, the older woman with the beautiful blue hair, you know, she's so shy and so unsure of herself in real life, whereas Emma's very kind of powerful and suave and very at ease with herself. But actually, sexually, they're so passionate and equal and together. And that was very moving. And also at the end of that, at that big long scene, it cuts straight to a pride march, which I thought was very moving as well.
There was a lot of great cuts between the private life behind closed doors, either be it the sex life or the emotional kind of turmoil that Adele in this case can be going through, versus the public life of, say, her role as a student in school, in class, mm-hmm, trying to pay attention, or when she becomes a teacher, her role as a teacher and holding face, yeah, in the public context as well, and showing it really did juxtapose those, the inner and the outer kind of what your life can be, really.
Absolutely. It was very, they had their own sort of private world, and then it seemed so separate from the rest, which is kind of the way a wonderful love affair does feel, you know.
It is a hugely naturalistic film in terms of style and the performances that we see from the actors, which is why they presumably were included in the awarding of the Palme d'Or, as well as the director. I saw in an interview that Adele had done, the lead actress in it, she said that every genius has his own complexity, and Kashish, the director, is a genius, but he's tortured. We wanted to give everything we have, but sometimes there was a kind of manipulation which was hard to handle. That is, I mean, to set that in context, there has been this kind of, as I put earlier in the show, like a kind of washing of dirty laundry in public between the two lead actors and the director. when I heard that, I thought, you know, directing is manipulation. A director once said to me, "He's like, directing is not about telling people what you want them to do. It's about telling them what they need to hear in order to get them to do what you want them to do."
Okay.
Which I mean, it entirely is manipulation. But it seems that this may have been pushed to the brink. And while the girls look like they're suffering at many points, it's because they are suffering at the difficulties of the filming process.
I mean, it's a really intimate film in every way. You know, in the sex scenes, I'm sure it was horrendous. Apparently that 10-minute sex scene took sort of 10 days to film. You know, he's countered with, you know, how ungrateful they are to say such a thing, which, you know, seems terribly unfair. But then now he sort of said, I want the film to be pulled because it feels dirty to me now that people just think that it's
been sullied by that people will have kind of preconceptions watching it about this stuff that we're talking about and probably feeding by talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but then as well, if you're going to put a 10-minute very graphic sex scene in a movie, people are going to talk about it, you know, and that is the worry with this film. I think the film is sort of better than all of that controversy and all. I think obviously it's we should find out exactly what went on. I think that, you know, you can push yourself in art to create something, you can push yourself to your own limits. I think the difficulty always arises when you've got somebody who's in a position of power, like a director or like a photographer, who is in charge of you, you know, and is trying to get something from you, and you feel like you have to give them what they want. You know, I think that's always a dangerous line to tread, and I don't know whether that's the case here. But that's always, like, you think of, you know, Alfred Hitchcock and Tippi Hedren when they were filming The Birds, and she had live birds being thrown at her for 5 days straight when she was told they were going to be mechanical birds. And you know, that it goes beyond the point of what's reasonable.
But at the end of the day, it is a great, it is a fantastic love story. It's not, I mean, the fact that it's you know, homosexual love story is completely irrelevant. It's nothing about that. It's about love between two people, regardless.
Absolutely. And it really is, it's one of the most powerful depictions of that I've seen in, that I can't remember when I saw something better than this.
Well, Blue is the Warmest Colour is due to open at UK cinemas on the 15th of November and on the 25th of October in the US. And if you'd like to contribute to the conversation or challenge us or take us up on something we've said or agree with us, whatever, I'm at D.I. Weiland on Twitter and Lisa's at Lisa H. Band. So please do get in touch.
So speaking of Twitter, over the course of a few pints, I've discovered that Dylan has not seen many seminal movies that he really should have done, because he is a mere pup. So this is a segment that I'd like to call the re-education of Dylan Haskins, which you can help me with on Twitter. Movies that he has not seen, for example, Point Break.
Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction.
I know.
Team America.
It's specifically things that pre-being over 18, because I just wasn't allowed to watch on over 18 films in the 90s.
Fair enough. So if you, I think your homework for next week is Point Break.
Okay, done.
Which is an absolute classic. I can't believe you haven't seen it. So if you could Twitter some suggestions that Dylan should watch of incredible 90s movie that Dylan should watch that he no doubt has not, to Twitter us. Again, it's at DIYLAN and at Lisa H. Band.
A Journey Through London Subculture, 1980s to Now, describes itself as not an exhibition, but a project or an experiment whereby the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London is seeking to test the existence of an interconnected legacy that can be traced back to the 80s and beyond. So to do this, they've taken over the old Selfridges Hotel off Oxford Street in London. And much like the ambitions of the ICA with this exhibition, the building too has been stripped back to reveal its bare concrete structure and all of the piping and the parts that went to make it up. The exhibition, when you walk in, the space now looks like this kind of industrial space, and you walk in and there's not one curator. They've each been given a vitrine, as it's called, a kind of a stand, a box, which they've been asked to fill with things. And there's about 50 of these in the room. It's a lot to get through.
It starts in the early 80s. The first vitrine is called Mudlarking, and it's has Nicola Tyson's photos of John Moore and Judy Blame, both fashion designers in the early 80s, gathering sort of bits of ceramics and bottles and effluents from the Thames and turn it into clothing and turn it into accessories. And it's just a really I think it's a great beginning because it's all about that sort of bricolage mentality of like taking something, taking what you have and making something beautiful and new with it. And I think the whole beginning of the exhibition is filled with such exuberance and such a sense of fun, and the whole thing just sort of smells like teen spirit. And I loved it. I loved that whole particular section.
Peter Ackroyd in the biography of London he says London is in a constant state of becoming, which is something that I thought interesting to think of in the context of this exhibition, because it is showing how it's constantly evolving, constantly in flux.
Yeah.
One thing is new and the next minute it's passé and something else has come and taken its place. But what I suppose they're trying to see in this exhibition is there a thread through all of these things? Can the DIY 80s countercultural heads, are they in some way linked to the young people doing all of the interesting things in London now? And I suppose it could be any city. It chooses London because it's so active at the moment as well.
Well, just taking that gang that we were just talking about, there was a couple of ladies in the fashion end from Beth and Laura Wood and Louise Gray, who I really felt you could see that thread going through, you know, and they had that sense of fun and exuberance that they had in the early 80s and really carried it through, and then like all of their beautiful clothes are sort of kind of ad hoc looking, and they looked like sort of found materials that they'd reconstituted, and you know, you could really sense that there was a direct correlation there. And then, you know, you can see connections, obviously, and I think any artist is standing on the shoulders of others, and always has done.
Especially in the 80s, people like, you know, my choreographer Michael Clark and company, and shows his work with The Fall, and then the filmmaker Charles Atlas, who had filmed some of his stuff and then worked with other people. And in the, you know, in the Charles Atlas film Hail the New Puritan about Michael Clark and company, you see people like Lee Barry, who is kind of such a presence on the London scene back then as well. I was walking around thinking, I'd love to see a diagram of all of these people and how they're all connected. And then I picked up the programme and page 4 sure is enough a diagram.
Yeah. I think at the beginning, that's what's so wonderful, is there's such a sense of community and such a sense of collective endeavour and inspiration and collaboration that, you know, it was so exciting, particularly the first bit. And I don't know whether when you're looking at something through the lens of time as well, it has a sense of itself. It has a sense of shape that sometimes things don't take until years after their time has passed. And so I think that the earlier stuff has that in its favour too, but also a lot of them just felt like sort of boxes that you pulled out of your attic.
I mean, let's talk about the stuff that's in them, because people have taken an entirely different approach to whether they turned their box into a light box and positioned some things on top of it, you know, or filled it with kind of ephemera or photos. Or one of them, probably the most unusual takes, is one that actually has a urinal pretty much passing through it.
Yeah, I think that's the White Cubicle Gallery, which I really love. It's a tiny gallery.
No one had used it, I know. The book, it was empty.
Oh my God, I certainly hope not.
There was also toilet paper, God forbid. Like.
Really? I would have avoided that whole area.
I mean, because
it's
a pop-up gallery, they have no toilet, so that's effectively, okay. Maybe someone would use it.
But there's so many threads they were gathering together. There was art and fashion and the club scene and magazines and architecture. And, it was really wonderful to see all of those different movements and how they all developed. I mean, some are more interesting than others.
But how they were all interlinked to try and give somewhat, or at least attempt getting a picture of what a scene looks like. Because often it's certain kind of iconic totems from a scene that people know, like that t-shirt or that particular style that got big. But it's never, you know, and that's the thing that surfaces to the mainstream and the thing that gets kind of like attached to it retrospectively. But many people of that scene would be like, well, that's not what it meant for me, or that's, you know,
absolutely,
that's just the one thing that, you know, people picked on. And
there was a few things that I knew about, but there was a lot that I didn't, and I really felt like it was a really interesting insight into into a world that I didn't know anything about.
It was a strange experience. Usually, you know, when you're doing some kind of retrospective exhibition, it stops off at a certain point a few years back. You never say up to now. What I found quite interesting in this was, as you move, and it is arranged in chronological order, I'm coming from the 80s, you know, when I was born, things I've kind of heard about or you know, subsequently read about that used to happen at one point and have influenced things that I know now. But then I started in the latter vitrine, seeing things that I know, places I've been, you know, Bistro Tech restaurant was there, in which is, you know, in East London, or Vogue Fabrics, a club in Dawson in London too as well. And these things which are, you're like, oh yeah. And what I found weird was, you know, in a way, when you put anything in a box on display, it's elevated to a kind of greater stance. To see things which were part of the kind of cultural geography of London now, in that context, I was like, well, maybe they're making that out to be a bigger deal than it is. I don't think it's that
important. I've been there on a wet Tuesday. That's what you mean. But I know, yeah. It was interesting. And it's, you know, how do you pick? I mean, obviously it's not a, you know, it's not set in stone, but it was interesting, the things that they did pick from now. And you could really see a sense of the commodification of art as time went on. You know, there was a much more sort of guerrilla sense of fun in the 80s, and it sort of
and even in the 90s changes. I think the YBAs and Damien Hirst and some of the stuff that they show of his early ideas is much more kind of playful, and almost it will be, you can't really say, less conscious of the art market that was about to engulf all of that, but it's certainly more grounded in what's happening, what his peers are doing and all of that type of things as well. There's a lot more players involved than just individuals who kind of get picked out and elevated. When, how do you represent a counterculture, which by its nature is so plural? There's no one leader in a counterculture. It's, you know, often non-hierarchical in terms of how these things work. People bounce off each other. Those people do that. They see it. And
especially now as well, with the internet, which sort of, you know, the internet is this giant choose your own adventure book that, you know, you can really find anyone anywhere that shares the same views as you and the same interests as you. And does that blur the lines, or does it make them more defined? I'm not sure.
What, one of the things which, you know, like DIY is something that meant a huge amount to me in my youth. And, you know, I made a documentary about DIY counterculture and it was for punk that got me into it. And I actually, when I got into punk, had no idea that DIY existed beyond punk, and was, as I started looking into it more and trying to make this documentary about it, realizing that actually, yeah, it was there with the, you know, in the 60s with the Whole Earth catalogue. I always find that a mouthful to say. And people like Ellen Lupton in the US, this curator of contemporary design in the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York. And I talked to her about it, and she said, you know, DIY is about giving the tools to the people that have something to say. And kind of looking at how DIY works now, it seems very much that DIY, it is almost like the raw material from which the mainstream gets its oxygen and changes, and how without DIY and this kind of counterculture, there would be nothing for the mainstream to feed off. It relies on it, and there's this kind of relationship between the two of them.
Absolutely, and things are sort of diluted and polished and the corners cut off, and then it's mass produced for everybody.
But it relies on it. You know, one relies on the other to bounce off and react against. And you wonder, with the idea of subcultures, you know, is a subculture something that's meant to be eternally a subculture, or something which is aspiring to, at some point, assimilating with the mainstream, or not aspiring to that, but is it destined to always happen that a subculture will merge with or become assimilated into what is the mainstream?
It does seem part of a natural cycle, doesn't it, of sort of growth and decay a bit, that maybe that is part of this, the cycle of a subculture, is that it does grow and grow, and then it dies off, and then it blossoms again 20 years later with a new generation who've discovered, you know, as we see in fashion all the time.
There is a big resurgence, I think, at the moment, in the past few years, in DIY ideas, from, you know, the terms which I cringe at now, like pop up this and pop up that, and you know a big emphasis on things like community gardens and technology as well, that people can literally, you know, publish their own works, and there's the means to distribute those. But I wonder, you know, if at the point at which people are no longer just being sold products, but they are making products and producing themselves, it seems to me that what capitalism is now doing to react to that is selling people the tools to do that. So capitalism will still survive. It's not like it's being undermined by people having this, you know, surge of creativity. It's just like, well, now we're going to sell you the tools to do that.
I think that part of the modern world, when everything is so mass produced and so corporate in every aspect of our lives, that people do crave things that are personal and things that are real. And I think that's what DOI brings. I felt the most exciting thing about that exhibition was that wonderful collaborative homemade spirit in the sort of mid-80s that was here. And, you know, people really doing things for themselves, doing things for fun, doing things just to make things, you know. And
I think the current same for young people now as it was then ever. I mean, it's if we talked about Blue is the Warmest Colour being a film about coming of age, I think DIY and counterculture is something that helps young people come of age and figure out what they're good at. And you can see from that exhibition people when they were young doing certain things, and then suddenly they went on to be huge, you know.
Yeah. So if you want to go and see A Journey Through London Subculture 1980s to Now, it's open at the Old Selfridges Hotel off Oxford Street above the food hall, delicious, in London until October 20th. And you can go to ica.org.uk if you want to find out more about it. Thank you so much for listening to our first podcast of Soundings, and we'll be back next week to talk about more things, in particular Dylan's thoughts on Point Break. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.